Chapter 23. This chapter describes how Lord Sri Krishna, after inducing the cowherder boys to beg for food, showed mercy to the wives of some brahmanas performing a sacrifice, and made the brahmanas themselves feel remorse. When the cowherder boys became very hungry, they asked Sri Krishna about obtaining food, and Krishna sent them to beg some from a group of brahmanas who were performing a sacrifice nearby. But these brahmanas ignored the boys, thinking Sri Krishna an ordinary human being. The boys thus returned disappointed, but Krishna sent them off again, this time advising them to ask the wives of these brahmanas for food. These ladies had heard of Krishna's transcendental qualities and were very much attached to Krishna. Thus, as soon as they learned that Krishna was nearby, they went to Krishna in great haste, bringing with them all four varieties of kinds of foodstuff. In this way, the wives of the Brahmins offered themselves to Sri Krishna. Krishna told the women that while one can develop transcendental love for him by seeing his deity form in the temple, or meditating upon him, or chanting his glories, one cannot achieve this result simply by being in Krishna's physical presence. Krishna thus advised the wives of these Brahmins that since they were housewives, their particular duty was to help their husbands perform sacrifices. Krishna therefore instructed the wives of the Brahmanas to return to their homes, and when these ladies went back home, their husbands at once felt remorse and lamented. For anyone inimical to Krishna, then one's three births, seminal, brahmana, and sacrificial, are all condemned. While on the other hand, these women folk, who have not undergone the purificatory process of the brahminical class, or performed any austerity or pious rituals, have, through devotion for Krishna, easily cut off the bondage of death. Since Lord Krishna's every desire is completely fulfilled, Krishna's begging for food was simply an act of mercy towards us brahmanas. All the fruits of Vedic sacrifice, and indeed all things on this earth, are the opulences of Krishna. Yet, out of ignorance, we could not appreciate this fact. Having spoken thus, all the brahmanas offered their obeisances to Lord Sri Krishna, hoping to counteract their offense. Nonetheless, out of fear of King Kamsa, the brahmanas did not go see Krishna in person. Chapter 24. In this chapter, Lord Sri Krishna crushes the pride of Indra by prohibiting a sacrifice intended for him and initiating a substitute sacrifice in worship of Govardhan Hill. When Sri Krishna saw the cowherder men busily preparing a sacrifice to Indra, Krishna inquired about it from their king, Nanda Maharaj, his father. Nanda explained that the rain given by Indra enables all living entities to maintain their lives, and therefore this sacrifice would be executed to satisfy Lord Indra. And so Krishna responded, "It is because of karma alone that living entities take birth in a certain body, experience varieties of happiness and suffering in that body, and then give it up as the karma pertaining to that body runs out. Thus, it is karma alone that is our enemy, our friend, our guru, and our lord. And Indra can do nothing to alter the happiness and distress of anyone, for everyone is tightly bound by his or her karmic reaction. The material modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance bring about the creation, maintenance, and destruction of this world. The clouds give forth rain when they are impelled by the mode of passion, and cowherders prosper by protecting the cows. Furthermore, the cowherder's proper residence is in the forest and on the hills. Therefore, my dear father, you should offer worship to the cows, brahmanas, and Govardhan Hill. After Krishna spoke like this, Krishna arranged for the cowherder men to worship Govardhan Hill with the paraphernalia collected for the sacrifice to Indra. Then Krishna assumed a huge, unprecedented transcendental form and devoured all the food and other offerings presented to Govardhan Hill. And as Krishna did so, Krishna proclaimed to the cowherder community that although they had worshipped Indra for so long, Indra himself had never appeared in person, whereas Govardhan Hill himself had now manifested before their very eyes and had eaten all their offerings of foodstuffs. Therefore, Krishna told them, they should all now offer obeisances to Govardhan Hill. And then Lord Krishna joined the cowherders in offering obeisances to his own newly assumed form. Chapter 25. This chapter describes how Lord Indra was overcome by anger when the residents of Braja cancelled his sacrifice. This chapter describes how Indra tried to punish the residents of Braja, sending forth a devastating rainfall to Vrindavan. And the chapter describes how Lord Sri Krishna protected Gokul by lifting Govardhan Hill and for 7 days using it as an umbrella to ward off the rain. Angered at the disruption of the sacrifice meant for him, falsely presuming himself the supreme controller as well, Indra said, "People often give up the pursuit of knowledge, which is the very means for self-realization, and imagine that they can cross over the ocean of material existence by mundane, fruitive sacrifices. Similarly, these cowherder men have become intoxicated with pride and have offended me by taking shelter of an ignorant, ordinary child, Krishna. To remove this supposed pride of the residents of Braja, Indra sent forth the clouds known as Sanvartaka, whose function is to facilitate the destruction of the world. Indra sent them to harass the Brajavasis with downpours of rain and hail. The cowherder community was very much disturbed by this, and they approached Krishna for shelter. Understanding that this trouble was the work of Indra, Krishna decided to smash to pieces Indra's false prestige, and so Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill with one hand. Then Krishna invited the entire cowherder community to take shelter in the dry space beneath the mountain. For 7 consecutive days, Krishna held up the hill until Indra finally understood Krishna's mystic power and then ordered the clouds to withdraw. And when the cowherder villagers emerged from beneath the mountain, Krishna put Govardhan Hill back in its proper place. The cowherders were in ecstasy, showing loving symptoms such as flowing tears and bodily hairs standing on end. The cowherders embrace Krishna, offering him benedictions according to their respective positions. Meanwhile, the demigods in heaven rained down flowers and sang the praises of Lord Sri Krishna. Chapter 26. In this chapter, Nanda Maharaj describes Krishna's opulences to the cowherder men, as Nanda had heard of them from Garga Muni. The cowherder men, unaware of Lord Krishna's power, were amazed to see Krishna's various extraordinary activities. The cowherder men approached Nanda Maharaj, telling him that after seeing how Krishna, a boy only 7 years old, had lifted a mountain, and how Krishna previously killed the demoness Putana, and had generated extreme attraction in the hearts of everyone in Vrindavan, the cowherder men had become doubtful and bewildered about how Lord Sri Krishna could have possibly taken birth in the unsuitable environment of a cowherder community. Nanda Maharaj replied, relating to them what Garga Muni had told him about Sri Krishna. Garga Muni had said that in the previous three ages, Nanda's boy had manifested himself in white, red, and yellow forms, whereas now, in the Dwapara age, Krishna had assumed his darkish blue form, or Krishna Rupa. Because Krishna descended as the son of Vasudeva, one of his many names is Vasudeva, and Krishna has innumerable other names indicating his many qualities and activities. Garga Muni had predicted that Krishna would prevent all sorts of catastrophes in Gokula, spread unlimited auspiciousness, and increase the ecstasy of the cowherder men and women. In a previous age, Krishna had provided protection for the saintly brahmanas when they were harassed by low-class dacoits and there was no proper ruler in society. Just as demons can never defeat the demigods in the higher planets who have Lord Vishnu on their side, so also no enemy can ever defeat those who love Krishna. In Krishna's affinity for his devotees, and in Krishna's opulence and power, Krishna is just like Lord Narayan himself. Overjoyed and awestruck by Garga Muni's statements, the cowherder men concluded that Krishna must be an empowered representative of the Supreme Lord Narayana, and thus they worshipped both Krishna and Nanda Maharaj. Chapter 27. This chapter describes how Asura Vikau and Indra, having seen the amazing power of Lord Krishna, performed a bathing ceremony for him. Ashamed of having attacked Vrindavana with a violent storm, Indra secretly came before Lord Krishna, offered obeisances, and praised Krishna. Indra stated that although Sri Krishna is never caught in the current of material illusion, which is born of ignorance, Krishna nevertheless accepts a human body and performs various activities to establish religious principles and chastise the wicked. By this means, Krishna crushes the false prestige of those who presume themselves great controllers. Indra then went on to declare that Krishna is Father, Guru, and Lord of all living entities, and that in his form as time, Krishna is the agent of their punishment. Satisfied with Indra's prayers, Sri Krishna told Indra that Krishna had stopped the Indra Yajna so that Indra, puffed up as he was with false pride, would remember Krishna. Persons intoxicated with material opulence never see Krishna standing before them with the rod of punishment in his hand. Therefore, if Lord Krishna desires the actual good fortune of some person, Krishna brings him or her down from one's position of opulence. Lord Krishna then ordered Indra to return to his proper position in heaven and serve there without egotism, without an inflated feeling of pride in one's superiority to others. Indra, along with the cow Surabhi, then performed a bathing ceremony for Krishna, using the water of the heavenly Ganges and the milk of Mother Surabhi. Indra and the cow took this opportunity to bestow upon Krishna the name Govinda, and the demigods showered flowers and recited various prayers. Chapter 28. This chapter describes how Lord Krishna brought Nanda Maharaj back from the abode of Varuna, and how the cowherder men saw Vaikuntha. The king of the cowherders, Nanda Maharaj, observed the prescribed fast on the 11th day of the lunar month, known as Akadashi, and then considered how to break his fast properly on the 12th day, Dwadashi. By circumstance only, a few more minutes remained, and so Nanda Maharaj decided to take bath at the very end of night, although astrologically, that was an inauspicious time. Thus, Nanda Maharaj entered the water of the Yamuna. But a servant of Varuna, the demigod of the ocean, noticed Nanda entering the water at a time forbidden by scripture, and thus took Nanda Maharaj away to the abode of Varuna. In the early morning, the cowherder men unsuccessfully searched for Nanda, but Lord Krishna immediately understood the situation and went to see Varuna. Varuna worshipped Krishna with great and variegated festivity. Afterwards, Varuna begged Krishna to forgive his servant for having foolishly arrested the king of the cowherders. Nanda was amazed to see the influence Sri Krishna exerted in the court of Varunadeva. And after returning home, Nanda Maharaj described his experiences to his friends and relatives. All of them thought Krishna must be the Supreme Personality of Godhead Himself, and they wanted to see His supreme abode. Thereupon, the omniscient Personality of Godhead arranged for them to bathe in the very same lake where later Akrura would have his vision of the Absolute Truth. There, Krishna revealed to them Brahma Loka, which is realized by great sages in their mystic trance. Chapter 29. This chapter describes how Lord Sri Krishna, intending to enjoy the Rasa dance, engaged in arguments and counter-arguments with the gopis. Then there is a description of the beginning of the Rasa dance and Krishna's pastime of disappearing from the midst of the gopis. Remembering the promise Krishna had made to the gopis when Krishna had stolen their clothes, Lord Krishna employed his yogamaya potency and manifested within himself the desire to enjoy pastimes during an autumn night. Thus Krishna began to play his flute, and when the gopis heard the sound of Krishna's flute, impulses of Cupid violently aroused within them, and immediately they abandoned all their householder duties hastily went to Krishna. All the gopis had purely spiritual bodies, but when some of the gopis' husbands and other family members stopped the young girls from going, Lord Krishna arranged for them to temporarily exhibit material bodies, which they then left at the sides of their husbands. In this way, the gopis deceived their relatives and went off to meet Krishna. When the gopis came before Lord Krishna, he asked, Why have you come? It is not good for you to travel to such a place in the dead of night, for this forest is full of violent creatures. Your husbands and children will soon come searching after you to bring you home and engage you once again in your householder duties. After all, the prime religious duty of a woman is to serve her husband and children. For a respectable woman to consort with a paramour is totally contemptible and is sure to obstruct a woman's progress towards heaven. Moreover, one develops pure love for me not by physical proximity, but by hearing topics connected with me, by viewing my deity form in the temple, by meditating upon me, and by faithfully chanting my glories. Therefore, all of you would do best to return home. The gopis were crestfallen hearing this, and after crying a little, they replied with a bit of anger, O Krishna, it is very unfair for you to reject young girls who have abandoned everything in their lives just to come to you with exclusive desire to serve you. By serving our husbands and children, we receive only pain, whereas by serving you, the dearmost soul of all living beings, we will perfectly fulfill the true religious duty of the self. Indeed, what woman would not deviate from her prescribed duties as soon as she hears your flute song and sees your wonderful form which enchants the three worlds? Just as the Supreme Lord Vishnu protects the demigods, you also destroy the unhappiness of the people of Vrindavan. Therefore, you should immediately relieve the torment we have felt because of separation from you. Wanting to please the gopis, Lord Krishna, who is always satisfied in himself, responded to their appeals by playing with them in various pastimes. But when this show of attention made the gopis a little proud, Krishna humbled them by suddenly disappearing from the arena of the rasa dance. Chapter 30. This chapter describes how the gopis, tormented through the long night by separation from Krishna, wandered about like madwomen from forest to forest, searching for Krishna. When Sri Krishna suddenly disappeared from the arena of the rasa dance, the gopis, their minds fully absorbed in thoughts of Krishna, began looking for Krishna throughout the various forests of Vrindavan. From all the moving and non-moving creatures, the gopis asked for news of Krishna's whereabouts. Finally, they became so distraught that they began imitating Krishna's pastimes. Later, while wandering in a corner of the forest, the gopis saw Sri Krishna's footprints, which appeared to be mixed with those of Srimati Radharani. Seeing these footprints perturbed them greatly, and they all declared that surely Srimati Radharani must have worshipped Krishna with unusual excellence, since she had been privileged to associate with Krishna in seclusion. Further along the path, the gopis came to a place where they could no longer see the footprints of Radharani. They then concluded that Krishna must have taken Radha onto his shoulders. Then, in another place, they noticed that Krishna's footprints were showing only his toes. And thus the gopis concluded, Krishna must have been picking flowers with which to decorate his beloved Radharani. And yet in another spot, the gopis saw signs that led them to imagine that Sri Krishna had been tying the locks of Radharani's hair. All these thoughts brought pain to the minds of the gopis. Because of the special attention Radhika received from Krishna, Sri Radha herself began to consider she was the most fortunate of all women. Radharani told Krishna she could walk no further and that Krishna would have to carry Radharani on his shoulders. But just then, Lord Krishna disappeared from Radharani's sight also. Srimati Radharani, extremely troubled, then began looking everywhere for Krishna. And when Radhika finally met her gopi girlfriends, she related to them what had happened. Thus, all the gopis went out to look for Krishna in the forest, going as far as the moonlight reached. But in the end, they were unsuccessful. So the gopis went back to the shore of the Yamuna and simply sang Krishna's glories in utter helplessness. Chapter 31. This chapter relates how the gopis, overwhelmed with feelings of separation from Krishna, sat down on the bank of the Yamuna and began praying for Krishna's audience and singing his glories. Because the gopis had dedicated their minds and very lives to Krishna, they were beside themselves with the transcendental pain of separation. But their crying, which appears like evidence of misery, actually shows their exalted state of transcendental bliss. As it is said, Yata deka Vaishnavir Vyabahara Duk Nishchai Jani Hase Paramananda Sukh. Whenever one sees a Vaishnava acting unhappy, one should know it for sure that he or she is actually experiencing the highest spiritual bliss. And thus, each of the gopis began addressing Lord Sri Krishna according to her individual mode of ecstasy. And all of them prayed for Krishna and his mercy. Then, the pastimes of Krishna spontaneously arose in the minds of the gopis as they sang their song, the song which relieves the agony of those suffering from the burning pain of separation from Lord Sri Krishna, the song which bestows supreme auspiciousness. They sang as follows. O Lord, O lover, O cheater, when we remember your smile, your loving glances, and your pastimes with your boyhood friends, we become extremely agitated. Remembering your lotus face, adorned with locks of blackish hair, smeared with the dust of the cows, we become irrevocably attached to you. And when we remember how you followed the cows from forest to forest with your tender feet, we feel great pain. So in their separation from Krishna, the gopis considered a single moment to be like an entire age. Even when they had previously seen Krishna They had found the blinking of their eyelids intolerable, for it blocked their vision of Krishna for a fraction of a second. The ecstatic sentiments for Lord Krishna that the gopis expressed may appear like symptoms of material lust, but in reality, they are manifestations of the gopis' pure desire to satisfy the Supreme Lord's spiritual senses. Therefore, there is not even the slightest trace of lust in these wonderful moods of the gopis. Chapter 32. This chapter describes how Sri Krishna manifested himself in the midst of the gopis who had become extremely disturbed by their separation from Krishna. After Krishna consoled them, the gopis expressed to Krishna their deep feelings of ecstasy. Having shown in various ways their great eagerness to see Krishna, Krishna, the attractor of Cupid, appeared before the gopis wearing silken yellow garments and a beautiful flower garland. Some of the gopis, overwhelmed with ecstasy at seeing Krishna, grasped his hands. Others placed his arm on their shoulders, while others accepted the remnants of betel nut Krishna had chewed. Thus, the gopis served Krishna. Impelled by loving anger toward Krishna, one gopi bit her lip, looking askance at him. Because the gopis were so attached to Krishna, they were not satiated even by continuously gazing upon him. One gopi placed Krishna within her heart, closed her eyes, and embracing Krishna within herself again and again, became absorbed in transcendental bliss just like a yogi. So in this way, the pain the gopis felt because of separation from Krishna was finally dissipated. And so, Lord Krishna went to the bank of the Yamuna in the company of the cowherder girls, who are his internal potencies. The gopis then made a seat for Krishna out of their shawls, and after Krishna had sat down, they enjoyed with Krishna, gesturing amorously. The gopis still felt hurt that Krishna had disappeared, and so Krishna explained to the gopis why he had done so. Krishna further told the gopis that he had come under their exclusive control due to their loving devotion, and thus Krishna would ever remain indebted to the gopis. Chapter 33. This chapter describes Lord Sri Krishna's rasa dance, which he enjoyed with his beloved girlfriends in the forest along the banks of the river Yamuna. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, is most expert in the knowledge of transcendental moods. And so, in the company of the gopis, who were tightly bound to Krishna by the ropes of affection and totally dedicated to his service, Krishna thus expanded himself into numerous forms. The gopis indeed became intoxicated with their enthusiasm to enjoy the rasa dance, and the gopis thus began satisfying the senses of Krishna, singing, dancing, and gesturing amorously. The sweet voices of the gopis filled the 10 directions. Even after Lord Krishna manifested himself in various forms, each gopi was thinking that Krishna was standing next to her alone. Gradually, the gopis became fatigued from the continuous dancing and singing, and so each of them placed her arm on the shoulder of the Krishna standing beside her. Some gopis smelled and kissed Krishna's arm, which bore the fragrance of the lotus, and which was anointed with sandalwood paste. Others put Krishna's hand on their bodies, and yet others gave Krishna pleasure by embracing him lovingly. Being the Supreme Absolute Truth, Lord Krishna is the only actual enjoyer and object of enjoyment. Although Krishna is one without a second, Krishna expands himself into many forms just to increase his personal pastimes. Therefore, great scholars say that Krishna's Rasa Leela is like a child playing with its own reflection. After all, Sri Krishna is self-satisfied and fully endowed with inconceivable transcendental opulences. When Krishna exhibits such pastimes as the Rasa Leela, all living beings from Lord Brahma down to the blades of grass become merged in the ocean of astonishment. When Maharaj Parikshit heard the narration of Krishna's conjugal pastimes with the gopis, which superficially resemble the activities of lusty, wanton persons, Parikshit expressed a doubt to the great devotee Srila Shukadeva Goswami. Shukadeva dispelled his doubts by stating, Krishna is the absolute enjoyer, and such pastimes as these can never be contaminated by any fault. But if anyone other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead tries to enjoy such pastimes, then he or she will suffer the same fate someone other than Lord Rudra would suffer if he or she attempted to drink the ocean of poison. Moreover, even one who only thinks of imitating Lord Krishna's Rasa Leela will certainly suffer misfortune. The Supreme Absolute Truth, Sri Krishna, is present within the hearts of all living entities as their indwelling witness. When out of his mercy, Krishna exhibits his intimate pastimes to his devotees, these activities are never besmirched by mundane imperfection. Any living being who hears of the spontaneous loving attraction the gopis felt for Lord Krishna will have his or her desires for material sense gratification destroyed at their root, and will also develop one's natural propensity for serving the Supreme Lord, the Spiritual Master, and Krishna's devotees. Chapter 34. This chapter describes how Lord Sri Krishna saved his father Nanda from the clutches of a serpent and delivered a Vidyadhara named Sudarshana from the curse of the Angi Rasa sages. One day, Nanda Maharaj and the other cowherder men placed their family members on their bullock carts and went to the Ambika Vana forest to worship Lord Shiva. After bathing in the Sarasvati river and worshipping Lord Sadashiva, another form of Lord Vishnu, they decided to spend the night in the forest. As they slept, a hungry serpent came and began to swallow up Nanda Maharaj. Terrified, Nanda cried out in distress, O Krishna, O my son, please save this surrendered soul. The cowherder men immediately awoke and began beating the serpent with wooden torches, but the serpent would not release Nanda Maharaj. Then Lord Krishna came, touching the serpent with his lotus feet. The serpent was immediately freed from his reptilian body and appeared in his original form as a demigod. He told them about his previous identity and described how he had been cursed by a group of sages. Then he offered his homage at the lotus feet of Sri Krishna and upon the Lord's order returned to his own abode. Later, during the Dola Purnima festival, Sri Krishna and Baladeva enjoyed pastimes in the forest with the young women of Braja. The girlfriends of Baladev and those of Krishna joined together and sang about the Lord's transcendental qualities. When Krishna and Balaram became absorbed in singing to the point of apparent intoxication, a servant of Kubera named Shankachuda boldly came forward and began abducting the gopis. The young girls then called out, "Krishna, please save us!" Then Krishna and Ram began to chase after Shankachuda. "Don't be afraid," Krishna called out to the gopis. In fear of Krishna and Balaram, Shankachuda left the gopis aside and ran for his life. Krishna chased after him, swiftly approaching, and with a blow of his fist, removed Shankachuda's jewel together with his head. Then Lord Sri Krishna brought the jewel back, presenting it to Lord Baladeva. Chapter 35. This chapter contains the songs the gopis sing to express their feelings of separation from Krishna when he goes to the forest during the day. As the gopis' mood of separation from Sri Krishna becomes ever more intense, Krishna's names, forms, qualities, and pastimes begin spontaneously manifesting in the hearts of the gopis. Thus they join together and sing as follows. The beauty of Krishna attracts the minds of all. When Krishna stands in his threefold bending way and plays upon his flute, the wives of the siddhas flying in the sky with their husbands become attracted to Krishna and they forget external reality. The bulls, cows, and other animals in the pasture become stunned in ecstasy, and they stand so still with the grass unchewed between their teeth that they appear like figures in a painting. Indeed, even the unconscious rivers stop flowing. Why, just see, when Krishna dresses himself in forest array and calls the cows by their names, blowing on his flute, even the trees and creepers become so ecstatic out of love that their limbs display eruptions and sap pours down like a torrent of tears. The sound of Krishna's flute causes the cranes, swans, and other birds in the lakes to close their eyes in deep meditation, while the clouds in the sky gently rumble, imitating the vibration of Krishna's flute. And even such great authorities in the science of music, such as Indra, Shiva, and Brahma, they also become astonished. And just as we gopis are anxious to offer everything we have to Krishna, so also the wives of the black deer follow Krishna about, imitating us. And when Krishna is returning to Braja, Krishna constantly plays his flute while his young companions chant his glories, and Lord Brahma and the other chief demigods come to worship Krishna's lotus feet. And so the gopis, feeling intense separation from Krishna, sing of his glorious pastimes. Chapter 36. This chapter describes how Krishna killed Arishta Asura and how Kamsa reacted when he learned from Narada Muni that Krishna and Balaram were the sons of Vasudeva. The demon Arista wanted to kill Krishna and Balaram, and thus Arista assumed the form of a huge bull with sharp horns. Everyone in Krishna's cowherder village became terrified when the Arista Asura approached, but Krishna pacified them, and when this bull demon charged Krishna, Krishna seized Arista by the horns and threw him about 6 yards. Though weakened, Arista still wanted to attack Krishna. Dripping with sweat, Arista charged the Lord once again. This time, Krishna grabbed Arista's horns, throwing him to the ground, thrashing him like a pile of wet clothing. The demon vomited blood, giving up his life. And then Krishna and Ram, while being honored by the demigods and cowherder boys, returned to the village. A short time later, Narada Muni, the great sage among the demigods, came to see King Kamsa. Narada informed Kamsa that Krishna and Balaram were not the sons of Nanda Maharaj, but rather sons of Vasudeva. It was out of fear of Kamsa that Vasudeva had put the two boys under the care of Nanda Maharaj. Furthermore, Narada said, Kamsa would ultimately meet his death at the hands of Krishna and Balaram. Kamsa, thus shook with fear and anger after hearing all of this, and in great agitation, Kamsa began thinking how to destroy Krishna and Balaram. Kamsa then called for the demons, Chanura and Mushtika, instructing them to kill the two brothers, Krishna and Balaram, in a wrestling match. Then Kamsa spoke to Akura, who was expert at executing his duties. Taking Akura by the hand, Kamsa persuaded Akura to go to Braja to bring the two boys, Krishna and Balaram, to Mathura. Akura agreed to carry out Kamsa's order and then returned to his home. Chapter 37. This chapter describes the killing of the horse demon, Keshi. It also describes Narada's glorification of Lord Krishna's future pastimes, as well as describing Krishna's killing of Vyomasura. On the order of Kamsa, the Keshi demon assumed the form of a huge horse and went to Braja. As Keshi approached, his loud neighing terrified all the inhabitants, and they began looking for Sri Krishna. When Krishna saw the demon, Krishna came forward, challenging Keshi to come near him. Keshi charged Krishna, trying to strike him with his front legs. But Krishna seized them, whirled the demon around several times, and then threw Keshi a distance of 100 bow lengths. Keshi remained unconscious for some time, but when the demon regained consciousness, Keshi furiously charged Krishna once again with his mouth wide open. Krishna then thrust his left arm into the mouth of Keshi, and as Keshi tried to bite Krishna's arm, it felt like a red-hot iron rod. Krishna's arm then expanded more and more, finally choking the Keshi demon. And in extreme agony, Keshi gave up his life. Lord Krishna then removed his arm, stood calmly, showing no pride at all at having killed the Keshi demon, as the demigods showered down flowers from the sky, glorifying Krishna with select prayers. Soon thereafter, Narada Muni, the great sage among the demigods, approached Krishna praying to him in various ways, glorifying Krishna's future pastimes. Then Narada paid obeisances and departed. One day, while tending the cows, Krishna Balaram and the other cowherder boys became engrossed in playing hide-and-go-seek. Some of the boys took the role of sheep, some the role of thieves, and others shepherds. The shepherds would search for the sheep when the thieves stole them. Taking advantage of this game, a demon named Vyoma, who was sent by Kamsa, dressed himself like a cowherder boy and joined the band of thieves. Vyoma abducted a few cowherder boys at a time, throwing them into a mountain cave and keeping them there by blocking the entrance with a boulder. Gradually, Vyoma Asura abducted all but four or five cowherder boys. When Krishna saw what the demon was doing, Krishna ran after Vyoma, grabbing him and killing him just as one would kill a sacrificial animal. Chapter 38. This chapter describes Akrura's trip from Mathura to Vrindavan, as well as Akrura's meditation on Krishna and Balaram along the way, and the honor Krishna and Balaram showed Akrura upon his arrival. Early in the morning on the day after Kamsa had ordered Akrura to bring Krishna and Balaram to Mathura, Akrura prepared his chariot and set off for Gokul. As Akrura traveled, he thought as follows: I am about to attain the great good fortune of seeing Sri Krishna's lotus feet, which are worshipped by Lord Brahma, Rudra, and the other demigods. Although Kamsa is an enemy of the Supreme Lord and his devotees, still it is by Kamsa's grace that I will get this great boon of seeing Lord Krishna. When I first catch sight of Krishna's lotus feet, all of my sinful reactions will be destroyed at once. I will descend from my chariot, falling at the feet of Krishna and Balaram. And even though I have been sent by Kamsa, the omniscient Sri Krishna will certainly harbor no animosity towards me. As Akrura thus thought to himself, he arrived in Gokula at sunset. Alighting from his chariot in the cowherder pasture, Akrura began rolling about in the dust in great ecstasy. Then Akrura continued on to Braja, and when he saw Krishna and Balaram, he fell at their lotus feet, and both the lords embraced Akrura. Afterward, Krishna and Balaram brought Akrura to their residence, inquiring from him about the comfort of his trip, and honored him in various ways, offering Akrura water for washing his feet, argya, a seat, and so forth. Krishna and Balaram relieved Akrura of his fatigue by massaging his feet, serving him a delicious banquet. Maharaj Nanda also honored Akrura with many sweet words. Chapter 39. This chapter describes how Akrura informed Lord Krishna and Balaram of Kamsa's plans and Kamsa's activities in Mathura. The chapter also describes how the gopis cried out in distress when Krishna left for Mathura. And the chapter also describes the vision of Lord Vishnu's abode that Akrura saw within the waters of the Yamuna. When Krishna and Balaram offered Akrura great respect and comfortably seated him on a couch, Akura felt that all the desires he had reflected upon while traveling to Vrindavan were now fulfilled. After his evening meal, Krishna asked Akura whether his trip had been peaceful and whether he was well. Krishna also inquired about how Kamsa was behaving towards Krishna's family members. And finally, Krishna asked why Akura had come. And so, Akura described how Kamsa had been persecuting the Yadavas, what Narada told Kamsa, and how Kamsa had been treating Vasudev cruelly. Akura also spoke of Kamsa's desire to bring both he and Balaram to Mathura in order to kill them on the pretext of their seeing the bow sacrifice and engaging in a wrestling match. Krishna and Balaram laughed out loud when they heard all of this. They went to their father Nanda, informing him of Kamsa's orders. Nanda then issued an order to all the residents of Braja that they should collect various offerings for the king and prepare to go to Mathura. However, the young gopis were extremely upset to hear that Krishna and Balaram would be going to Mathura. They lost all external awareness and began remembering Krishna's pastimes, condemning the Creator for separating them from Krishna. They began to lament. They said that Akura did not deserve his name, since Akura was so cruel to be taking away their dearmost Krishna. Oh, it must be that fate is against us, because otherwise the elders of Braja would have forbidden Krishna to leave. So let us forget our shyness and try to stop Lord Madhava from leaving us. And with these words, the young cowherder girls began to chant Krishna's holy names, and they cried. But even as they wept, Akura began taking Krishna and Balaram to Mathura in his chariot. The cowherder men of Gokul followed behind on their wagons, while the young gopis also walked behind for some distance. But then they became placated by the glances and gestures of Krishna, and were pacified by a message from Krishna which said, "I will return." So now, with their minds completely absorbed in Krishna, the cowherder girls stood as still as figures in a painting until they could no longer see the flag of the chariot or the dust cloud being raised on the road. Then, chanting Krishna's glories all the while, the gopis despondently returned to their homes. Meanwhile, Akura halted the chariot at the bank of the Yamuna so that Krishna and Balaram could perform a ritual of purification and drink some water. After Krishna and Balaram had gotten back onto the chariot, Akura took their permission to bathe in the Yamuna. And as Akura recited Vedic mantras, Akura was startled to see that Krishna and Balaram were now standing in the water. Akura then came out of the river, returning to the chariot. But he saw that Krishna and Balaram were still sitting there just as he left them. So then Akura returned to the Yamuna to find out if Krishna and Balaram were real or not. What Akura saw in the water was now a four-armed form of Lord Vasudeva. His complexion was dark blue, like a fresh rain cloud, He was wearing yellow garments and lying upon the lap of the thousand-hooded Anantashesha. Lord Vasudeva was receiving prayers from perfected beings, celestial serpents, and demons, and Vasudeva was encircled by his personal attendants. Serving Vasudeva were his many potencies, such as Sri, Pushti, and Ila, while Lord Brahma and other demigods sang the praises of Lord Krishna. Akura rejoiced indeed upon seeing this vision, and joining his palms in supplication, began to pray to the Supreme Lord in a voice choked with emotion. Chapter 40. This chapter relates Akura's prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna and Balaram. Lord Brahma, who created this visible world, emanated from the lotus navel of the Supreme Lord, Garbhodakashayi Vishnu. The five elements of physical nature, the five corresponding objects of perception, the ten senses, the ego, the total material nature, the primeval creator, and the demigods, all of these originate from the bodily limbs of Garbhodakashayi Vishnu. But he cannot be known by sensory knowledge, and thus even Lord Brahma and the other demigods are ignorant of Krishna's real identity. Different classes of people worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead in different ways. Fruitive workers worship Krishna by performing Vedic sacrifices. Philosophers worship Krishna by renouncing material work and pursuing spiritual knowledge. The yogis worship Krishna by meditating. The Shaivites worship Krishna by worshipping Lord Shiva. Vaishnavas worship Krishna by following the injunctions of scriptures such as the Pancharatra. And other saintly persons worship Krishna as the original form of the self, of the material substance, and of the controlling demigods. Just as rivers flow from various directions into the ocean, the worship of those who dedicate themselves to these various entities finds its ultimate purpose within the Supreme Lord, Vishnu. The form of the total universe, the Virat Rupa, is imagined to be the form of Lord Vishnu. Like aquatics moving about in water, or like tiny insects burrowing into a fruit, all living beings move about within the Supreme Lord. These living beings, bewildered by Krishna's Maya, wander along the path of material work, falsely identifying with body, home, and so forth. Under the sway of illusion, a foolish person may overlook a reservoir of water covered by grass and leaves, and instead run after a mirage. Similarly, living beings caught within the grip of ignorance abandon Lord Vishnu and instead become attached to their bodies, homes, and so forth. Such faithful servants of the senses cannot take shelter of the Supreme Lord's lotus feet. Only if by Krishna's mercy they get the association of saintly devotees will their material entanglement end. And only then can they develop Krishna consciousness by serving the Lord's pure devotees. So after showing his Vishnu form to Akura within the waters of the Yamuna, and after receiving the prayers of Akura, Lord Krishna withdrew that vision just as an actor winds up his performance. Akrura emerged from the waters and in great amazement approached Lord Krishna, who then asked him whether Akrura had seen something wonderful while bathing. Oh my Lord, whatever wonderful things that are in the realms of water, earth, or sky, all have their existence within you. Thus, when one has seen you, Krishna, nothing remains unseen. And so, Akrura began driving the chariot once again. Chapter 46. This chapter describes how Sri Krishna sent Uddhava to Braja in order to relieve the distress of Nanda, Yashoda, and the young gopis. One day, Lord Krishna asked his intimate friend Uddhava to take news of him to Braja and thus relieve his parents and the gopis of the misery caused by their separation from Krishna. Riding on a chariot, Uddhava reached Braja at sunset. Uddhava saw the cows returning home to the cowherder village and the calves jumping here and there as their mothers followed slowly behind, weighed down by their heavy milk bags. The cowherder men and women were chanting the glories of Krishna and Balaram, and the village was attractively decorated with burning incense and rows of lamps. All of this presented a scene of exceptional transcendental beauty. Nanda Maharaj welcomed Uddhava warmly into his home. The cowherder king then worshipped Uddhava as non-different from Lord Vasudeva. Nanda fed Uddhava nicely, seating him comfortably upon a bed, and then inquired from Uddhava all about the welfare of Vasudeva and his two sons, Krishna and Balaram. Nanda asked, "Does Krishna still remember his friends, the village of Gokul and Govardhan Hill?" "Oh, Krishna protected us from a forest fire, wind and rain, and many other disasters. By remembering Krishna's pastimes again and again, we are relieved of all karmic entanglement. And when we see the places marked by Krishna's lotus feet, our minds become fully absorbed in thought of Krishna. I remember Garga Muni told me that Krishna and Balaram have both descended directly from the spiritual world. Why, just see how Krishna and Balaram have so easily dispatched Kamsa, the wrestlers, the elephant, Kuvalaya, Pida, and many other demons." As Nanda Maharaj remembered Krishna's pastimes, his throat choked up with tears. He could no longer speak. Meanwhile, as Mother Yashoda heard her husband speak of Krishna, the intense love she felt for her son caused a flood of milk to pour from her breasts, and a torrent of tears fell from her eyes. Seeing this super excellent affection Nanda and Yashoda had for Sri Krishna, Uddhava commented, "You too are indeed most glorious. One who has attained pure love for the Supreme Absolute Truth in his human-like form has nothing further to accomplish. Krishna and Balaram are present within the hearts of all living beings, just as fire lies dormant within wood. These two lords, Krishna and Balaram, see everything equally. They have no particular friends or enemies. They are free from egoism and possessiveness. Krishna and Balaram have no father, mother, wife, or children. They are never subject to birth, and they have no material body. It is only to enjoy spiritual happiness and deliver their saintly devotees do Krishna and Balaram appear by their own sweet will among various species of life, both high and low. Lord Krishna is not merely the son of you, Nanda and Yashoda, but Krishna is the son of all persons, as well as their mother and father. In fact, Krishna is everyone's dearest relation, inasmuch as nothing that is seen or heard in the past, present, or future, among the moving or non-moving, is independent of Krishna. Nanda Maharaj and Uddhava passed the night talking about Krishna in this way. Then the cowherder women performed their morning worship and began churning butter, singing the glories of Sri Krishna as they busily pulled the churning ropes. The sounds of the churning and singing reverberated into the sky, cleansing the whole world of all inauspiciousness. And when the sun rose, the gopis saw Uddhava's chariot at the edge of the cowherder village, and they thought perhaps Akura might have returned. But just then, Uddhava finished his morning duties and presented himself before the gopis.